case study of someone who is using neuroplasticity. We're also going to be looking at several of our key terms that we're focusing on right now. One is optimism, another one is mentorship. But this really fascinating story of a woman who, if we took a snapshot of Jane Goodall at your age, we would never, ever, ever have thought this woman is going to make a contribution to anything, anywhere. She just did not seem remarkable at all. But she became a major world figure and made huge advances, created a whole field of primatology, gave us complete new insights into not only primates and their behavior, but also by looking at them, we can understand the origins of mankind and to understand ourselves in a much more fundamental way. So how did this happen? So Jane Goodall was born in 1934 in London. The kind of important thing to think about here is, 1934, by 1939, England was in World War II. So when she's 5 years old, World War II starts. And for 6 years after that, England is absolutely obliterated by the Nazi bombs. And so she's in London, and her whole family has to move out of London because of the bombing. And so they have to just flee and get away from their home. And the war is tearing up everything in the whole country. They're just spending all their time and effort trying to fight this miserable war. So from age 5 to 11, she's in this country that's completely bombarded with war. And it's affecting her family enormously. They move out of London, move to her grandmother's house out in the country. Her father, Mortimer, was a very famous race car driver. He was a champion race car driver. There were good things and bad things about that. He was highly competitive, and he transferred a little of that to Jane. He also had a capacity for intense concentration. He also transferred some of that to Jane. And he was physically tough. He was, the rigors of race car driving are huge, and so just his body, his stamina, he was physically tough. But it also meant because he was racing cars all over the world, he was gone a whole lot of the time. So he was kind of an absent father during the time Jane was growing up, and eventually her parents divorced because he just was gone so much. But he was like the only race car driver to compete in Le Mans for 11 consecutive years. He was a championship race car driver. Her mother, Van Morris Goodall, was a stay-at-home mom and a very, very nurturing, very supportive, very cheerful person. She didn't have a career, but she did do a lot of writing. And eventually some of that writing, by the time Jane was an adult, she was doing some writing with some accomplishment. And Jane and her mom were just friends for life. They were really, really tight from her childhood all the way through her adulthood. So when she was 2 years old, her father gave her a present. And this present was a stuffed chimpanzee. And in this chimpanzee, if you squeezed it, it played a tune in its belly. So it was this cute little stuffed toy. It was made as a celebration for a chimpanzee in the zoo in London, whose name was Jubilee. And Jubilee had been born, in captivity, and that was quite unusual. And so as a commemoration of this, thing that had happened in the zoo, they made this stuffed animal. And that was her favorite toy as she was growing up. It's kind of predictive somehow. She's interested in this chimpanzee even at an early age. When Jane is 5 years old, one day she just goes missing, and nobody knows where little Jane is. They've moved by that time out to the country, and they're at grandma's farm. And so they're really panicked because this is a city girl. She doesn't know much about the country. They're afraid she's gotten lost or something horrible has happened. They call the police, and the police come. They search the whole farm, and they're looking around, And finally, little five-year-old Jane turns up. She's got straw in her blonde hair. And it turns out that she had been in the chicken coop. And she was curious about how do chickens lay eggs? I see these eggs. How does that come out of a chicken? I don't get it. So she laid down in the chicken coop and just laid there really quietly for 5 hours until the chickens came and roosted, and she was underneath them and she could see them lay eggs. So this is a curious child who also is intense and has a lot of patience. And she figured out how do hens lay eggs. I still don't quite figure out how hens lay that big fat egg, but whatever. Jane figured it out. She also always loved animals as a kid. She had lots and lots of pets. Her family didn't have much money. I mean, they'd been displaced by the war, and the dad's a race car driver and didn't make a lot of money. But she always had lots of pets. She wanted to learn how to ride horses, but the family couldn't afford lessons. So she shoveled shit in the stables in exchange for lessons. So she made an exchange of work for being able to learn how to ride. So she was really, really keen on horses. But she had all kinds of other pets, too. She had guinea pigs, and she had racing snails, which she raced with her friends. She had legless lizards, who were her pets. And she had a whole series of dogs. One time she came from a fairly affluent family of origin. I mean, they had been in pretty good shape, and they were a pretty influential family. But they didn't have any money anymore. They'd run through the money. So she had an uncle who still had some money. And one time for her birthday, he gave her this extremely elaborate dollhouse. Thought, it's a beautiful little girl. I'm going to give her this great dollhouse. She's going to love that. Well, Jane wasn't exactly into dolls. So she didn't have much appreciation for the dollhouse. So with her mother's permission, she sold the dollhouse in order to buy a dog. And the dog's name was Rusty. And Rusty became like her closest friend and her companion. And she was very, very attached to Rusty, who was her pet. So she's, at an early age, totally into pets. She also lives in this very matriarchal household. Her grandmother, whose farm they were living on, she had been married to a minister, quite a well-known minister, but he died at an early age. So she had to raise her three girls by herself, and that's part of why they didn't have any money to speak of. But so in this household where Jane grew up, it was all women. It was her grandma. All three of those daughters lived in that household with grandma through this period. So Aunt Ollie and Aunt Audrey lived there, and her mom, Van, lived there. And then Van had these two girls, Jane and Judy. So the household was all women. And Jane said, I was never told I couldn't do something because I was a girl. Everybody was girls. So anything that got done by a girl or a woman. So she never thought that was any restriction. She loved to read. Her three favorite books were The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, Dr. Doolittle, where Dr. Doolittle talks to the animals, and Tarzan of the Apes by Burroughs. And all of these, of course, were about exotic African jungle environments with all these exotic animals. So she had these fantasies about that as a kid. When she's 12 years old, she starts what she calls the Alligator Club. And this was some of her friends that they got together, and they studied wildlife, the wildlife of the farm. And they also had fundraisers to try to raise money to keep horses who were past their useful life on the farm. And often they'd be put down after they were no longer useful on the farm. And she thought that was awful that they got killed. So She and her friends raised money to buy feed so these horses wouldn't be put down. And in this alligator club, they all took on names of different animals. She was called Red Admiral after a particular kind of spider that she studied and she admired. So she's into animals. But okay, she gets to the point where she's graduating from school, and what does she do with her life? Well, there really isn't. She's a woman in an era where women did not have much opportunity, and the thought of going to college, her family didn't really have the money, so they couldn't send her to college. So she didn't have very good prospects at that point. And her mom decided, you really ought to just go to secretarial school, because, you know, that's a useful skill that you can use all your life. So you need to learn how to type and how to take shorthand. Her mom said a secretary could find work anywhere in the world. That's the safest bet for you. So she goes to London and goes to secretarial school, and she gets training in typing and in shorthand. And then when she graduates, she gets a job at Oxford University as a secretary. Super boring job. She hated this job as a secretary doing typing and shorthand in an office at Oxford University. In that period, though, because her family historically had been an important family, her mother insisted that she become a debutante. And so that meant going to all these parties and having this kind of social life and getting presented to the queen. So when she's like 20 years old, she gets presented to the queen. It's just a kind of hokey leftover from another era, but it kind of lets you know the environment she's in. Yeah, that's what a girl does. She gets all dressed up, she's pretty, she gets presented to the queen, and then she goes back to being a freaking secretary. And, you know, nothing's happening for her. She's living in London. She changes jobs because she hates her job at Oxford. And she goes back into London, and she begins working for a film company. And that's a lot more enjoyable. She likes the job a lot better, but it doesn't pay at all. So she can barely afford an apartment in London. She's living in a basement apartment with no windows, and it's a miserable apartment. She likes the job, but she doesn't have any money. She is attractive, and she has all these male friends. Just in 1 year, she dated Horst, Brian, Hans, Knight, Trevor, and Keith. Keith and she begin to kind of, you know, get something going here, and so he's madly in love with her, and he wants her to marry him. And, of course, that's kind of the normal thing she'd do. You know, it saves her from being a secretary all her life. He's got a bright future. He's got an education. He's from a good family. So this would have been the right thing to do at age 20, 21. But she just can't see herself getting married and settling down. It just doesn't feel right. So about that time, her dog, Rusty, dies. He's still back on the farm, but she's going back to the farm periodically and visiting. And oddly enough, his death seemed to release her. Now I don't have an obligation to stay here and you know, have this normal life. If I don't have if Rusty's not around anymore, I don't feel guilty about just leaving, and I want to go somewhere. So she had a friend from school who her family owned a big farm in Kenya. And of course, all this fantasy she'd had about Africa and the Jungle Book and all that, she just thought that would be fantastic to go to Kenya. So she saves up every penny she possibly can from her job. She borrows some money from her mom, and she takes a freighter, not a passenger boat, but a freighter to go from London to Kenya. And then she's going to take a train and go to see her friend who lives out on a farm in rural Kenya. But the idea is that she just stays with her friend long enough to kind of get established, and then she just wants to live in Africa and see what it's like to live in Africa. So she gets a job in Nairobi, in the biggest city in Kenya, and And her, she's a secretarial job, you know, not a good job, but it pays the bills. But somebody in her job says, you know, you should really meet this guy, Louis Leakey. Really dynamic guy. At this point, Leakey's in his 50s, and she's like 25 years old. And so she makes arrangements to meet Louis Leakey. Louis Leakey is, he's an archaeologist, and he has his PhD from Cambridge. He's president of the Pan-African Congress of Prehistory. He's really looking at the origins of man, but doing it through archaeology. He, at that point, was the author of 8 books. He was the curator of the National Museum of Kenya in Nairobi. That was his day job. He was also a notorious skirt chaser, so his probable initial interest was that, you know, here's this young, attractive woman. And so she and he begin to kind of hit it off, but he's probably thinking in one particular way, and she's totally thinking just, I need someone who I can learn from, and I'm interested in what he does, and I just want to find out more about it. So she ends up going on a dig, an archaeological dig, with Leakey and his wife, and they go to Olduvai, which is one of the areas where the earliest evidence of human inhabitation is in Olduvai. And so she's fascinated by what they're seeing out there. And so she spends 6 weeks out there on this dig and just, you know, doing shit work on the dig. In that time, she has these conversations with Louis Leakey. And he is very interested in the origins of mankind, and that's what he's doing his archaeology in. But it also occurs to him that these primates that are here around us everywhere in Africa, they're the predecessor for humans. We could learn so much about early humans if we knew more about primates, about how they operate, how they form communities, what they eat, how they use tools. It would help us understand the origins of mankind. So he always had this fantasy of somebody doing work in Kenya that would help him understand what happened before there were human beings, what happened when it was primates. And he had a couple of abortive attempts at trying to get this work done. He hired a guy for a while as an assistant, and he thought this guy was going to be interested in it, but turned out he was just completely inept at it. Here, there had been a secretary of his who he thought would be good at this, and tried to get her interested in it, but they had an affair, and it got messy, and she had to leave, and so that didn't work out. But he's interested in that, and he's talking to Jane about it, and Jane is super intrigued by this notion of what can we learn from primates about the origins of humankind. And Louis Leakey really knew Africa extremely well. He'd grown up in Africa. He was a white guy, but he'd grown up in Africa because his parents were missionaries there. So he knew the scene in Africa extremely well, and he had already identified this place called Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania, where there were primates that were living in a completely unspoiled environment. There had never been human beings in that area. It had been a preserve for a very, very long time, and you could find primates really behaving just as they always had for millennia. So he figured this is the place to really study and see what is primate behavior about. So Leakey tells Jane that she's the one to do these studies, and he will help her try to get funding. And so she jumps ship from her job that she had, starts working as a secretary in the museum where Leakey is the director. And she sets up shop in Nairobi, gets an apartment, and begins to work very closely with Louis Leakey. She always was fending the guy off. There was a lot of sexual harassment going on here, but she told him in no uncertain terms, this is a parental relationship I have with you. You're like my dad, okay? So there's not going to ever be anything besides that. I want to learn from you. I'm interested in what you do, but it's a parental relationship. And she set the guy straight, and, you know, that's what it was. She gets this cool apartment in Nairobi, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in the basement of the museum. And Louis Leakey says, yeah, if you want to decorate your apartment with this crap that we have in the basement, yeah, I'll take it out. So there are a lot of, you know, stuffed animals that she took into her apartment, and she started this whole menagerie in her apartment. So she's got hedgehogs, and she's got spiders, and she names everything. So Circe was her spider. She had a cocker spaniel that she bought. She had a mongoose named Kip, and then poor Kip was a little lonely, so she got a female mongoose named Mrs. Kip, and then she had little baby Kips. She had a pet snake in the apartment. She had these tiny, tiny little primates that she was quite interested in. And she got a little bitty, tiny monkey called Levi. And she had a kitty cat, a Siamese cat named Nanky Poo. So she's got this whole menagerie in her apartment there in Nairobi. But she's there thinking that Leakey is going to get her funding to do this study, but the funding is not happening. And so she stays there a couple of years and then finally decides, number one, she's out of money and she's not getting paid anything much for being a secretary in the museum. And so she just kind of has to go back to London and make a little money and begin to pay her mom back, who had given her the money to come over initially. So she gets a job in the London Zoo, and she's working as a librarian in their film department. And she loves that job, and that's working out pretty well. But still, what she really wants to do is go back to Africa, and she wants to do this study. Now, remember, she has no education. She has secretarial school, and she's trying. Obviously, it's extremely hard to get funding for this person with no qualifications to go out and do this study. But finally, Louis Leakey gets a grant himself, and he peels off some of the money from the grant, and he says, okay, I can use this to support you for a little while doing this study. So she's ready to go back to Africa. She starts getting all her permits to do this study. And one of the things that is the Tanzanian government requires is that she has to have an escort. She has to have someone who's supervising her. A woman alone can't go and do this study, so she has to have an escort. But in the rules, it doesn't say a male escort. The presumption is it's some guy who's taking care of her, but she didn't have any guy to take care of her. She didn't want anybody out there taking care of her, so she asked her mom to come with her and be her escort. Well, of course, they never imagined it was another woman, but they couldn't get around it because it didn't say it had to be a guy. So she and her mom, in May of 1960, they go to Gombe, or they go to Africa, to begin this study with a tiny little shoestring budget from Louis Leakey. So she's 26 years old when she's doing this. Now, no one had really done much study of primates up to that time. It's phenomenal to think that, you know, at that point, people didn't know anything about primates, really, especially not primates in the wild. Once you put them in a zoo, all bets are off. They're not really behaving like primates anyway. But nobody knew what they were like in the wild. There had been this guy, Henry Nissen, who was a psychologist at Yale, and he had done some studies of primates. And the way he'd done it is he would get in a blind, like a deer blind, a box with some little holes in it, and he would look out and he would observe the primates. And presumably, they don't know he's there, and he's observing them without influencing their behavior. But he was stupid. And that study actually got a lot of misinformation. So he observed a lot of things that turned out not to be true at all, because he wasn't really able to see that well. He's in a box somewhere and he's observing these primates at a distance. That was in the 1930s when he did that. So there's really not much precedent for how you go about this. So Jane and her mom go down there, and the first thing they do is they identify a little community of vervet monkeys that are not too far outside Nairobi on an island. And she's going to try out techniques with the vervet monkeys before she makes the big jump going to Gombe Stream to do the bigger study. So there really were three ways that were considered reasonable for doing this kind of study. One would be to use a blind, like Henry Nissen. So she sits in a box with little holes in it, and she peeps out and becomes a peeping Tom, observing the wildlife around her. But of course, what are the chances they're going to be around your box? In fact, they probably avoid your box like the plague. So how much are you really going to see? The second technique was baiting, where you put out food to attract the animals, and then you observe them because they're coming closer to you to get the food. But then you've already intruded on their way of life. You're already disrupting what they normally do, what they naturally do. So the behavior you're observing may be screwball because you've already interrupted their normal behavior. And then the third thing that was done was what was called visual tracking, where you stay behind them and you follow them and you try to make them not notice you're there, but you're wandering around behind them watching them. But the truth is, they are smart and they knew you were there, and in fact makes them incredibly suspicious, the fact that you're skulking around. And so you don't get very good observation out of that. So none of these three normal ways of observing primates was promising. So Jane, in experimenting with these vervet monkeys, comes up with a fourth option, which she calls habituation. And it's a process of openly allowing the animals to get accustomed to her. So she would just go and become another animal in the forest. So they can accept the lions and tigers and bears and snakes and other animals around them. Why couldn't they accept Jane as just a part of the forest? And it would take a while, because at first she'd be alien, but after a while they might get used to her, and then they might just continue their normal behavior like they would if there were a mongoose or if there were a horse or something else in the environment. So that was the idea that she started out with. And she and her mom go out to Gombe Stream and begin this study in July of 1960. She's 26 years old. She has no training. She is not a scientist. She knows really nothing about primates. She's starting from total scratch. Okay, so I want to talk about how hard this was. This is like way, way harder than you can imagine. So for one thing, she's all by herself out there. Her mom is there and she's not there. She goes back to London periodically. So a lot of times she's just there all by herself out in the forest. And what she does is she goes out and she just lives among the monkeys all day, every day, for months and months and months. And she just observes what's going on there. It's incredible hardship. It's hotter than hell. This is extremely difficult terrain around there. It's the middle of the jungle. She's scratched and she's bloody and she's getting infections and she's getting sick. She got malaria 8 times. And malaria is a horrible, horrible disease. So she's kind of by herself out there, throwing up, not being able to keep anything down, sick with malaria, high fever. This is her life. She also never had steady funding, so she's constantly worried about, can I sustain this any longer? And Louis Leakey is helping, but basically she has no money out there, and so she can't even get rudimentary supplies. She has a pair of binoculars. Those are super important in observing these primates, as binoculars. Another scientist comes and visits her, and he takes a look at her binoculars and says, "These are the worst binoculars I have ever seen in my life. They are just horrible quality. You really can't see very well through these." She said, "I know, but that's all I can afford." So he just gave her his binoculars and said, look, you need to at least be able to see what you're looking at. So he gave her his binoculars. She's just on a shoestring on everything there. And it's a very difficult, difficult place to be. Some of the things that we've looked at before that Jane had in spades, definitely independent thinking. She's just out there inventing things day by day by day, figuring it out on her own. Incredible confidence. Oh my God, to think that even you can survive out there in the wild like that. This, you know, kid that grows up in London and on a farm in England. I mean, how does she even think she's not going to die out there? But she has the confidence to pursue it. And she also is totally rebellious. You know, even things like, okay, here are the three ways you can observe these monkeys. And she says, well, no, I don't think any of those work. I've got another way I want to think about doing this. She just has this rebellious streak. She developed tremendous powers of observation, and this is where she's rewiring her brain. She doesn't have any particular capabilities, but she goes out there and all day, every day, so she's doing exactly what we said is great for neuroplasticity. Intense periods of demanding things of her brain, the ability to observe and see everything that's going on. She does that day after day after day, very intensively. And she develops these incredible powers of observation. She can see what other people can't see. She can record in her head what other people can't record. She develops those parts of her brain that observe in an intense, intense kind of way. And this is self-education at a very, very, very high level. And then she also is constantly doing new things. She's never repeating herself. So she's always trying out new techniques. She's always going to a different area. She's always experimenting. And that's, again, rewiring her brain always to think of more creative ways to do this. And of course, she's incredibly physically active. It's a very demanding environment, just physically, just strong and tough. So it's a lot of hard work. That's basically what she's doing for this whole period of time. And I want to talk a little bit here about two things that were extraordinary in terms of our second 10 terms. I am so interested in this woman's optimism. How in the world did she get so optimistic? And I want us to think ourselves. That's kind of a big focus today. How do you acquire this trait of optimism? Because she had to be extremely optimistic. She had to think there's a good outcome that's going to come of this. And she just all the way did think all the time. She always thought, this is going to turn out great. I'm going to find some things out that are going to be important, and this is all going to be fantastic. Although it was shit. You know, how could you be so optimistic? And especially, she doesn't really have any evidence or qualifications that would make her optimistic. But she had this powerful, powerful optimism. And she always did think that this was going to work out. She wrote all these letters back to her mom and her sister in England. And her favorite word in the letter is super. Everything's always super. I've got malaria, but, you know, it's really super. Things are going great here. It's ridiculous. I've read some of those, the accounts from those letters, and she's having dire hardship, but she's incredibly positive about what's going on. Even when she has malaria, she's like, you know, extremely positive. She never has the money. But she's always certain that it's going to work out. She's always positive that there's going to be a good outcome, that somewhere the money will appear, and we'll be able to extend this a little bit longer. So just super optimistic about that. And just this genuinely happy person. So I want to know, where does optimism come from? How do you rewire your brain to be more optimistic? Can you do that? Is it even possible? Where did Jane's optimism come from? And I've got three suggestions for where her optimism came from. And we'll talk about that for a minute. And then I want to know from you, Do you think it's possible to make yourself more optimistic? Because I swear, at least in her case, she would never have been the kind of creative person. She would never have had the kind of creative accomplishments if she had not been optimistic. Optimism was super, super key for her. So I think it came from three things. Number one, she grew up in an environment where they did not have a ton of money or resources, but where everything always did work out. I mean, it was the middle of the war. Bad things were happening all around. But her mom, her grandmother, her aunts, they were resourceful people. In the end, everything worked out. So it wasn't that she was in this fluffy childhood where there were no problems. There were problems. But she could observe these women who she lived with always somehow making things work out. So why wouldn't she be optimistic? Things had always worked out in her life on a shoestring without great resources. So that may have been part of her optimism. And I don't know, this means, you know, think about yourself. You probably have, a lot, most of you, a pretty good reason to be optimistic. Because many, many of you grew up in environments where everything has pretty much worked out for you and for your family. So, you know, is there any reason not to be optimistic? So in her case, I think some of that came from her family background. A second thing that I think contributed to her optimism is she surrounded herself with positive people. So people like Louis Leakey, who was an extremely positive guy. He always thought, yeah, there's, well, he was optimistic himself. He was just like what she became. But, you know, if you surround yourself with downers, it's very hard to be optimistic. If you surround yourself with people who are likewise positive, then it's much easier for you to be optimistic. So I think that was a second key thing that contributed to her optimism. And then I think a third thing was she decided to be optimistic. She decided that I am going to be positive. I'm not going to let things get me down. And you can read that in these letters where she's being realistic about what's going on. But she's deciding, I'm going to make lemonade out of lemons here. It's tough here, but I'm going to make this work. And she decided to be optimistic. And after doing that over and over and over again, pretty soon, it's pretty natural. She is rewiring her brain to be optimistic. And she's deciding, I'm going to intensely train myself to be positive about what's going to happen. Okay, so I want to know from you, do you think you can make yourself more optimistic? Do you think optimism is an important trait for being ambitious, being creative, inventing new things, trying new things, being adventuresome? What is the role of optimism? And do you think you can acquire optimism or intensify optimism? What do you think?
I think optimism is really closely related to fear. Mm-hmm. The more fear you have, the less optimistic you are. So like in Jane's case, she never really had fear of things. No one ever told her she couldn't do something. Mm-hmm. So she kind of went for everything full-headed.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you can acquire that?
I think, yes, you can intensify it for sure. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You just have to lower your fears, uh-huh, I guess, in life.
Uh-huh. That's a good point. What do other people think about this?
I think because she was very determined, that led to her being a more optimistic person. You have certain people where they tell themselves, I have to get this done, I can't fail. And when you tell yourself that, you have no choice but to be optimistic.
So the alternatives weren't all that bright for her. A dead-end job as a secretary, or marrying some guy and, you know, not having a very challenging life. So yeah, this is what she wanted to do. And she had to make herself optimistic in order to, you know, this was what she wanted to achieve. This was the tool she needed to do it. Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's definitely a quality that can be acquired by anyone, but I think that it's not necessarily acquired the same way for everyone. So, like, in a way, like, it can be, like, harder for others and easier for others, just, like, by the circumstances that you have, like, grown up in. And I think that it's, like, it's important to find the way that fits you.
So what might be an example of a way you could increase your optimism?
I guess just, like, the idea of, like, surrounding yourself with, like, those kinds of people and, like, cutting out the people that are kind of dead weight and kind of, like, hold you down rather than push you forward.
I think that's a super key thing. I mean, it's almost like you could just go out and try to have your radar turned on and focus on people who are optimistic. I want to hang out with people who are positive. So I'm just going to constantly be on the lookout for positive people, because I don't want to be dragged down by people who are more negative or dead weight, as you were saying. Yeah.
I think that confidence has a lot to do with being optimistic, because if you're really confident like her, then you can be very optimistic because you believe in yourself. Yeah.
I think those are very closely linked. They're not the same thing, though. You can actually be confident, but not as optimistic, not always thinking there's going to be a good outcome here. This is really remarkable to think that going into anything, this is going to turn out great. Something good is going to come of this. That is more than just confidence. That's a kind of, you know, outlook on the positivity of the world, and that, you know, things happen that are good. What do you think?
I think that optimism comes with a fear of, or not necessarily fear, but a comfortability with the unknown. So I think that a way to develop it is just find yourself doing more things that you're unsure of, and then you'll see that, I mean, like Jane, things have a way of working out, and that'll help you develop optimism.
I think that's risk-taking can make you more optimistic, because when you take that risk and it turns out okay, it's that incremental small successes thing, which helps with confidence, and it helps with optimism too. That if things turn out great, then you think, well, you know, there's a pattern here, and it keeps going. Okay, this business of what is your attitude toward optimism, how do you increase your optimism, is this a tool you're interested in, those are good questions. Her optimism led to incredible patience and tenacity. It took her 3 months of this habituation to have one primate acknowledge her and begin to let her in. So this chimpanzee called David Graybeard, she of course named all of these animals she's observing. David Graybeard had a little gray in his beard, and she identified him and could locate him every time she's observing this clan. And it took 3 months for any of those primates to allow her to get close enough she could observe them. And David Graybeard was the first one. And he just got a little bit curious about her. But it took enormous patience to just hang around and hang around and hang around until David Graybeard accepted her. And then David Graybeard became the link to all the other chimpanzees, who then in the end accepted her as well. But it took incredible patience and tenacity. Okay, so one of the things, super important, optimism in her development. Another really important thing, another one of our key terms, is mentorship. We talked about mentorship a good bit with Temple Grandin last time. But this is another kind of mentorship. This is mentorship by someone who knows what you want to know. The mentors in Temple Grandin's life were just well-meaning family members or friends who just supported and nurtured Temple Grandin. But the mentorship here is people who know something that can be helpful to you. You got to remember that, you know, even up to 26 years old, when she goes out to Gombe the first time, she has no scientific background. She didn't even take the science courses in high school. She had no scientific background. And what she's trying to be is a scientist. So she needs a lot of help. And science is not something you can just bullshit your way through. And what she was trying to study was not something she could just intuit. She had to get some real knowledge and capability in it. Now, Louis Leakey was a phenomenal mentor to her. He knew science. He had a PhD in archaeology, and he knew how to do field research, and he knew how to get funding for field research, and he knew how to record his findings, and he knew how to publish them in important journals and get a dialogue going with a larger scientific community. He knew all those things that she didn't know. And getting contact with Louis Leakey in Nairobi when she was 25 years old, that was a huge, huge benefit for her. He repeatedly found funding for Jane. The sources that supplied his funding, he'd go back and say, don't you want to give a little more and support Jane doing her work as well? He advised her and educated her. He just taught her basic science that she didn't know, and she would go on some digs with him, and she would just absorb all this new material that she had never had exposure to before. He handled a lot of her logistics. She had no idea how to do field work, what kinds of supplies you're going to need, what kind of medicines you better have on hand, how to deal with the natives, how to communicate with them, how to get help. He helped her understand how to do field work and all the logistics that went with that. And he gave her his contacts in Africa, but also his contacts in the larger scientific community. He was already an extremely well-respected scientist, and he was famous. He was well-known. So for him to be able to introduce her to these people, that was an enormous benefit to her. And in fact, miraculously, at a certain point, she goes out there and she's doing these observations, and Louis Leakey is convinced that she's finding some important information here. And he then wants her to get some of this published. But there's no way anybody's going to publish the work of someone whose qualifications are secretarial school graduate. No scientific journal is going to publish your work when you have no credentials. So he said, you're going to have to get a PhD. Well, she hadn't even graduated from college. She'd never gone to college. She just went to secretarial school. And miraculously, he gets her accepted into a PhD program with no undergraduate program at Cambridge University, because he had the contacts there, and he told these people, this is a woman you need to pay attention to. This is mentorship at the very highest level, using his influence to get her into this PhD program. He also, she was extremely frustrated with never being able to document what she was observing. Photography was so difficult for her. For one thing, she's in the tropics, and this is still the time of film photography. And film goes bad in hot, humid climates. So she'd shoot a bunch of rolls of film, and then she'd take them in 2 months later when she got back to Nairobi to have them developed, and they were all ruined by the humidity and the heat, and the film was deteriorated, and they were unusable. She had her sister come, who knew something about photography, and tried to do photography. It was just incredibly difficult, and she, National Geographic wants to publish something on her work, but National Geographic is a picture book. You have to have photos of all this, and there needed to be documentation of what you're observing. She had such a hard time with photography. Louis Leakey put her in touch with this photographer named Hugo van Lavik. He actually was a baron, royal family of Belgium, and he went out and worked with Jane, and he got the first photography of the work she was doing there. But that was through Louis Leakey. Turns out, the two of them fell in love. They got married. So she became Baroness Jane Goodall, married to Hugo van Lavik, her photographer. So one huge mentor is Louis Leakey. Another enormous mentor was this guy, George Shallow. He was a trained scientist. He studied gorillas. And he was in a different part of Africa. But she knew he was about the only guy doing parallel work to what she was doing. But he knew what he was doing. He was a trained scientist. So he came and spent time with Jane, and he told her what to look for. She was observing, but she didn't know what was consequential and what was inconsequential. So there were two things he told her you need to be looking for. Do these primates eat meat? That's the connection between human beings, because what sets us apart from most other primates is we eat meat. So do chimpanzees eat meat? Nobody knew that. They thought they were herbivores. But she was the first one to discover, no, chimpanzees eat meat. And that was a big connector to them as predecessors for human beings. But he was the one who told her to ask the question. She didn't know what she was looking for. I need to be figuring out, do they eat meat? Another thing was he said, you need to figure out, can they use tools? Because that's another thing that connects them to human beings. You need to be observing whether they're using tools. She hadn't thought about that. And the very first thing she observed in that regard was she saw David Graybeard take a straw, a stiff straw, and stick it down in an anthill and let the ants climb up that straw and then suck those ants off that straw for dinner. But he was using a tool. And that was a major breakthrough to figure out, yes, these chimpanzees know how to use tools. So George Shaler was the one who helped her understand what are you supposed to be looking for. And she figured out that they do eat meat, and she figured out that they do use tools, and those were breakthrough discoveries. A third important mentor was a guy named Robert Hendy. This is when she went to Cambridge, he was her dissertation advisor. And when she started looking for somebody to work with there, he said, I don't know anything about chimpanzees. You know, I'm not the right guy to work with. But nobody knew anything about chimpanzees. So she finally convinced him to work with her. He was one of the few scientists anywhere in the world who was taking on women students. And he took on several women students before Jane. He was extremely hard on his women students and often drove them to tears. He was very hard on his male students as well. There was a kind of joke among his male students that you better count your chest hairs before your seminar with Robert Hendy and after your seminar with Robert Hendy, because he's totally emasculating. And he was just a really, really tough guy. But he taught her how to really be a scientist. Women frequently broke down in tears with him, but he taught Jane the language of ethology. He introduced her to standardized check so that when you go to observe on that day, you look at all of the conditions that are there. What are the same with other days that you've been observing and what's different? And that helps you understand why behavior might be different today than another day. So that's something she had no idea about that, but that's standard scientific field work is standardized check. And he made her rigorous about that. He got her to add rigor to her narrative. She was just describing what was happening. It needed to be tighter. It needed to be more precise. It needed to be comparative. And he sent her graduate students to help. So she was spending half her time at Cambridge and half her time at Gombe. And she needed help. So he would send his graduate students out to be assistants to her in her research at Gombe. So again, fantastic mentor who was a scientist helping to teach her how to be a scientist. The fourth person here is David Hamburg, and he helped Jane establish a steady funding stream. He was American, and he got her on the American lecture circuit. Now, this is another example of her constantly challenging herself to do something out of her comfort zone. She is spending all her time out in the forest with monkeys, you know, alone. That's her world, that's her life. And somebody's asking her to go on the lecture circuit and talk to all these people in America about her science. She has no comfort with making big presentations to large audiences. She's scared to death of that. But this guy said, this is your ticket to getting constant funding. Because if you get people in America interested in the science you're doing, if you make it popular, if you make it something that's covered in the media, then when you go to that foundation and you show them the evidence of the interest in this, then they're going to fund you. But if you're just out there in the Gombe National Reserve all the time and nobody knows who you are and you're never spreading the word, you're not going to get funding. Nobody's going to pay for you to do this. So he taught her how to play the game of getting funding. And he got Stanford behind Jane's work. He got her an academic appointment at Stanford. So now she's got kind of a prestigious credential. And he taught her really how to be in the important world of science in the United States, where a lot of funding was coming from. So these are her four primary mentors. Now, the point I'm making with this is, I think, especially if you're interested in going into a special field, you need to have mentors in that field. You need to have people who know what they're doing in that field. And that was really a quantum leap for Jane. There's no way she could have done what she did if she didn't have people who are helping her in that regard. And again, just like looking for those optimistic people, how can I connect with positive, optimistic people? Also, how can I connect with people who know something I want to know? Because I need mentors of that sort. And I emphasize again, all four of those mentors, they got something out of it too. It wasn't like it was a one-way street. They enjoyed being mentors to Jane. They shared in her success. They got great satisfaction out of helping her. And then, you know, they sent her graduate students. Those graduate students came back better than they were before. So, like, everybody benefits here. But mentorship was very, very important with her. She would have said she had other mentors. One of her mentors was Rusty, her dog, who she just feels like she learned a lot from, just observing him and having a relationship with him. And then also David Graybeard, who she had a 40-year relationship with David Graybeard. Chimpanzees live a long time. And she and he connected. And 40 years later, they were still very good buddies. He died a few years ago. Jane's still around giving lectures all over the world. So she's making all these discoveries. She's becoming really an integral part of their community. Now she can habituate very easily because they accept her. From 1961 to 64, she's in Cambridge getting her PhD. She's also in Gombe, going back and forth between the two places. At the age of 28, she publishes her first major article on the research she's doing in National Geographic. She gets those photographs she needed so badly. And she's on the cover of National Geographic at age 28 and begins to get this presence in the scientific community. In 1964, she marries Hugo von Laveck, her photographer. At age 29, she establishes a permanent animal research center in Gombe and begins to get long-term funding from foundations that will keep this work going, and she can be assured that she can plan a five-year program and an eight-year program and begin to accumulate some knowledge over a longer period of time. At age 32, she receives her PhD from Cambridge and becomes an official scientist. In 1967, her son Grubb is born, and she juggles now. And she gets divorced from her husband, so she's a single mom, and she's raising this kid in Africa, in Cambridge, and traveling all over the world, lecture circuit. She's also got a personal life and very much being a mom. At age 37, she publishes her first real book, scientific book called In the Shadow of Man. And that really establishes her as a scientific expert in an emerging field called primatology. And she was one of the pioneers of this field of primatology, which is the study of primates. And she's like the godmother of that field. Enormous accomplishment there. From 1965 to the present, she's been running Gombe Stream Research Center. And now it does, there are lots and lots of scientists from all over the world, not just Jane doing her research, but other people doing research there as well. At age 52, she publishes her magnum opus, which represented 25 years of research and data collection on primates, in particular chimpanzees, and is the definitive work on this connection between primate behavior and human behavior. And she's, she's investigating every aspect of their life and our life. So she looks at diet and nutrition and health. And it took 25 years of habituation and research to really understand, how do they operate in terms of their diet and nutrition and health. She looked at their sexuality and procreation, how they form families, what kind of nurturing they have, how they form clans and communities. She looked at their leadership, how that develops, how notions of aggression are dealt with within the community, how some primates become dominant and then they become less dominant, and how all that political power works. She also begins to understand what is individuality in a primate, what is individuality in a human being, how do they tolerate variations and differences among themselves. She is what Louis Leakey was looking for, which was someone who could figure out, before there were human beings, what were the characteristics of these early primates and predecessors to human beings. Her work also created a new generation of primatologists. She was very much a teacher, always passing that information and knowledge on to the next generation. She had many, many graduate students out there at Gombe. She revolutionized field research methods. Everybody does it the way Jane invented now. There's just no question. She is the gold standard of how you do these field research studies. And she established a path for female scientists in all fields, because she was one of the very first really outstanding, world-renowned female scientists. From 1986 to the present, she's been a huge environmental activist. So she's gone beyond just studying the science of those primates, but she has become a big advocate for reforestation and for the establishments of habitats and the preservation of habitats for these animals. So this is a woman who's creative in so many ways and has made a great contribution through that creativity in science and in really larger scientific community and in culture and society. Just what is the role of a woman? What is the role of science? What is our understanding of ourselves and our sense of community? She's been an amazing advocate for all of that. So Twitter card.